Hi, my name is John D. Shaw. I'm 63 years old, and I'm here today, September 4th, 2014, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, with my friend and colleague Ron Surgeson.
And I am Ron Surgeson. I am age 63, and I'm here in Grand Rapids as well, September 4th, 2014, with John. And the reason we're here today is to pay homage to a former colleague of mine by the name of G. Robert Vincent, or Bob Vincent, as we know him. Mm-hmm. And I had the great good fortune of being Bob's personal assistant at the National Voice Library, as it was called then, at Michigan State University from approximately 1969 to 1973 when he retired. And the reason we're here today is also because we both felt that this opportunity with StoryCorps was apropos to Bob's entire career and what he made possible back a long time ago in 1912 when he recorded Teddy Roosevelt and started his career. And the reason I have John here today, I guess I'll let him tell his role in this and how he fits.
Okay. Lots of parallels between you and I in this, Ron. I am currently working at the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library. I've worked there since 1974. And the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library is what became finally of the National Voice Library after Bob Vincent's retirement. The name was changed to honor Bob. Bob retired in 1973. I started just about the time shortly after he retired. And I was assistant to Dr. Maurice A. Crane, who became head of the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library in January of 1974. So we were both assistants to very, 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 very smart, very talented men who had worked together. The Voice Library is a unit of the Michigan State University Libraries. It is a unique collection of spoken word recordings, sound actuality dating back to 1888. We have currently something along the lines of 40,000 hours of audio recordings, certainly more than 50,000 items, and the voices of over 200,000 people. The collection is primarily analog tape recordings and discs. And we did collect on analog medium until 2000, but of course now we collect digitally. And we are going back and digitizing all the recordings that Ron and Bob Vincent worked on in the 60s and 70s. Bob Vincent, a very unique individual, he a collector of recorded sound, very famous in that world. He worked in Edison Labs. He had his own recording studio in Radio City in New York. He invented the multilingual translation systems that were used both at Nuremberg and the United Nations, and came to Michigan State University Libraries in 1962 along with his private collection. And then again followed by Dr. Maurice A. Crane, who was head of the Voice Library in 2000. What we have today is a really unique opportunity. I met Bob in the hallway a couple of times, just talked to him briefly. My relationship with Bob is really me reading about him and saying his name every day when I talk about the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library. What we're most fortunate to have here is Ron Surgeson, who actually worked for Bob. So, Ron, maybe you can give us an idea of Bob's story and your relationship with Bob.
Well, you know, Bob is thus far the only one we haven't heard from. So I'm thinking, yes. You know, if we play this little recording that you were so kind to bring, mm-hmm. which is Bob talking about how he got started in this, mm-hmm. and this turned out to be, as Maury Crane pointed out, this turned from a hobby to a career to a lifetime pursuit.
Passion, incredible passion.
Yeah,
yes.
And he, you know, everything he did was with... was kind of guided by his early experience at Edison Labs, I think, mm-hmm. and Thomas Edison's early visions for recording, which were voice recordings. Mm-hmm. You know, there was never any idea back in the 1890s that yes. this was going to be a great commercial success and, mm-hmm. and music and so forth. Mm-hmm. Thomas Edison thought that this was all about recording voices of history.
Yes, absolutely.
And so we've got a little vignette here, I guess, as Bob would call it.
Yes.
That has to do with how he got started in this, and I'm just going to roll tape.
Okay.
Murray, I once told you the story of how I got started recording the voices of people I admired. Here it is in brief. In 1912, I was a member of a boys' club in New York whose principal aim was to get our parents and older relatives to vote for the Bull Moose candidate for president, Theodore Roosevelt. I was known among the kids as a friend of Teddy's, for I had met him and he commended me on a little amateur publication I edited after school. Therefore, several of the boys asked me to get Teddy Roosevelt to speak at the next meeting of our club a week hence. Well, I had to accept the challenge and try. So four of us went out to Oyster Bay, Long Island, in a Model T Ford, driven by an older boy, and after considerable difficulty, got an audience with Colonel Roosevelt at his home, Sagamore Hill.
That's quite an achievement, as a matter of fact, for youngsters and a candidate for the presidency of the United States.
Well, he was a pretty kind-hearted man, and he liked boys. He had a lot of boys of his own. I didn't really believe that I could get him to come to the meeting, so we borrowed an Edison cylinder recording machine with the help of young Charlie Edison.
That's the Charlie Edison who became Secretary of the Navy and then later Governor of New Jersey. The
same man, yes. We took this along just as a precaution. When Teddy came downstairs to receive us, he said that he had three other speaking engagements for that evening. So I immediately asked him to say a greeting to our members into the phonograph, which we'd brought along. Oh, he was somewhat reluctant, but when he saw our disappointment, he let me set up the machine and talked.
The principles for which we stand are the principles of fair play and a square deal for every man and every woman in the United States. A square deal politically, a square deal in matters social and industrial. I wish to see you boys act as good citizens in the same way I'd expect any one of you to act in a football game. In other words, don't flinch, don't foul, and the line on.
This was the only ad-libbed and by far the best recording in existence of the voice of Theodore Roosevelt.
It is incredible that it was made not in a studio but in a living room, and not by an engineer but by a very young Boy Scout.
Boy Scout. Of course, Teddy wasn't elected in 1912, but he came in second in a three-cornered fight.
And the man who came in third, after all, was the incumbent president of the United States, William Howard Taft.
So there you have it. There's Bob Vincent at one of the earliest StoryCorps recordings ever made, I think. And he was joined there. That other voice was Maury Crane.
Maury Crane, yes.
And himself, quite a character.
Right. They worked together long before Dr. Crane became head of the voice library. They did a radio program called Spin Back the Years, and were good friends.
And, you know, my musical background had me interfacing with Maury. I don't know if you knew this. But I know he was quite a clarinet player.
Yes.
And had, you know, had his, I don't remember what the jazz group had.
Geriatric Six.
Yeah. The Geriatric Six. And I played some Dixieland along the way.
Okay.
And communicated with him about it from time to time.
Okay.
So Maury was a good guy, too.
Yes.
So there you have it. That's Bob Vincent going way back. But there's a lot more to add to this. And I think maybe what we should do is talk about Bob's career so that people get a broader view of what he did.
Yes, please.
And then I can take off a little bit and talk about some of the things that I knew about him personally, because
yes,
he was a close friend for many years until he died.
Mm-hmm.
But Bob considered himself a voxologist, and I think that's a word he coined, voxologist, because he felt that the character was evident in the voice of a person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if I could call him the master voxologist, that's what I would call him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a voice archivist, a sound man, a raconteur, a little bit of Barnum. You know, he did it all, and he was fearless. And that's how I knew him, as a guy that you know, that would take on any comer, and virtually always win because mm-hmm. of because he was a smart, smart man.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you know, he started early on with this boys' paper that he referred to in the recording.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what it was called, mm-hmm. was the boys' paper. Mm-hmm. And his mother was in the newspaper business, so he, you know, picked up his creative and literal sensibilities, I think, from his mother,
mm-hmm.
and started this little paper. And once he recorded Teddy Roosevelt, as he described, that kind of kicked off his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But then he went on to do some interesting things like running away from home. He wanted to become a war correspondent. And when World War I started, he stowed away on a ship to England and got away with it until he got there, and they locked him up. But he escaped and eventually got to France. And at that point, he got a job. What was he doing in France? He was...
messenger.
He was a messenger, and because he spoke fluent German, he was originally from Austria before he moved with his mother to New York. She remarried. So he was fluent in German, and they needed German interpreters because they figured they'd have a certain number of prisoners, and they needed somebody who could talk with them and relay information. And along the way... Bob was, I remember him telling me he was knocked out or shell-shocked or something because, you know, he got too close to a weapon, and he was unconscious and mm-hmm. in the hospital. And in the hospital, he started speaking German. So he was detained as a spy in France. And, of course, his parents didn't know where he was. His parents were back in New York, and, you know, the kid was gone. And so then the jig was up. And they got in contact with officials in the United States and got him back home. And he had probably got a good licking, you know, for that. But that kind of springboarded him in his own way, springboarded him into the theater. Because during the war years, there were quite a number, I guess, of things related to war subject matter. And vaudeville was hot, and there were musicals and things related to the war. And so he was a kind of a hot commodity. He was called the boy who went to war.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can find my notes here, I have the name of the actual musical that he was in. It was called Her Soldier Boy. Mm-hmm. And it was in 1917, and he actually had a speaking part in this musical. And so now he's back in New York, and he's got a profile again. And this is just kind of indicative of the way his life went. He just went from one thing to another thing.
Mm-hmm.
After World War I, at some point he went to Yale. As far as I know, he attended there 2 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know
what... That's
what
I'd always heard.
Yeah. He didn't stay there long, but he did some newspaper work. And then at some point went to work for Edison Labs. And he worked on preservation of cylinder recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe he took those cylinder recordings and then re-recorded them, put them on discs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, this was probably around, I don't know, late 20s, I guess.
Yeah.
And so they started trying to preserve what Edison had started in the previous century.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in 19... I guess it was earlier than that, because in 1920, when Prohibition dawned, that's when Bob made some money doing his rum running.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another story. I remember. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'd heard that story that he carried a 22 pistol and a shoulder holster, and when he was doing business as a rum runner. That's a story I'd heard.
I wouldn't be surprised. They were after those guys.
Yeah.
But I do remember he used to carry an article that was in one of the New York papers. Back then there were lots of New York
mm-hmm.
papers, but there was an article with a photo of him in whatever his big, long car was with an alligator in the back. And what he did was he had the car rebuilt so that you could load cases of scotch under the floor.
Mm.
And then he would always take an alligator back up north, and that was his cover. that he was taking the alligator to the zoo. And he got this article printed in the paper, and he carried that with him when he was traveling. Mm-hmm. And if he ever got stopped, he could say, well, I'm taking this alligator up to the zoo. And that's why the car's riding so low, yeah. And so on and so forth. So he got away with it and made quite a bit of money, as I understand. Uh-huh. And he bought a lot of property down in Florida. Uh-huh. And that was fine until the Depression. And then that pretty much all evaporated. Uh-huh. So all his wealth that he'd amassed through that little episode, went away. So, he had to get creative again. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, he worked for some studios in New York, and he did some recordings and some freelancing. Mm-hmm. Until he started his own studio called the Vocarium.
Right.
And that was in Radio City. Mm-hmm. And there are endless stories of people that visited him at the studios, mm-hmm. and wanted things recorded or wanted copies made of things. Mm-hmm. And
it's a new industry too. I mean, it wasn't. I mean, he was really a pioneer in doing this kind of work.
Yes, he was.
It's something we take for granted, and all of us do every day on phones and recording everything. This is very, very new stuff.
And that's a good point, because all of these things, when you look back on it, the first half of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. was such a tumultuous time in terms of technologies.
Yes.
And he was very much into technology, mm-hmm. and very much into history.
Right.
So he was the right guy at the right time.
Yes, and the collection shows that kind of mix. I mean, his recordings are excellent renditions of... He really pioneered transferring from the Edison cylinders. And I have a piece of the device, the Edison playback machine that he used, and he put the pickups on there to generate the signal, to change to electronic signal, then to do the recording. And he also did filtering on early recordings, too, which is really unheard of. So he was a pioneer.
And he was far more technical than I was. Mm-hmm. I had more of the musical side covered. I don't think he was had much in the way of musical skills, although... Mm-hmm. His future work got him into the music deeply. Mm-hmm. But he never talked much about music, although I knew that he had Bob Dylan, contemporary music of my time. I knew he had a Bob Dylan album, and he had Simon and Garfunkel, and, he would stay abreast of what was happening in the music world. Mm-hmm. But he was more of a technical guy, mm-hmm. and more of a writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a writer and had that historical... point of view that mm-hmm. that he lived by. So that's in the 30s. He's back in New York.
He had famous people come, and he recorded them when he was in New York, right? I mean, he had, didn't Admiral Byrd come to the studio to get, I believe he did a recording there, and he did blues guys, too.
Fats Waller.
Yeah, Fats Waller, right.
Well, he's more of a jazz guy, but in fact, I think the last Fats Waller recordings were done at Bob's studio.
Okay.
Admiral Byrd, that's another story, because mm-hmm. Admiral Byrd was looking for a place to stay and a place to have office space, and Bob had space adjacent to his studio. So Admiral Byrd was really in the same office, and Bob kind of partnered with him on a bunch of things, okay. and eventually did a program called Adventures with Admiral Byrd. Huh. And so they were real buddies. Mm-hmm. And a typical example of the things he would fall into in his role in New York at that mm-hmm. time. Then World War II, we got through the 30s, and then World War II started to fire up, and that's really what I think was the heart of his career. Mm-hmm. And that centers around, the first major project he did was V-discs, mm-hmm. victory discs for, the armed forces overseas. And during the war years, when nobody could get vinyl to make records, Bob's outfit was the only one, through the special services of the Army, he was mm-hmm. the only one making records during mm-hmm. World War II. And I've heard the figure 30 million records went overseas mm-hmm. To the soldiers. And mm-hmm. ultimately, this went from the Army to the Navy mm-hmm. to the Marines. Everybody wanted these recordings because it was such a morale booster.
Yeah, along with the devices, too. They had spring-wound phonographs that traveled, so they could listen to these in the field. And they were, I think they called the disc unbreakable, didn't they? I mean, they were certainly tough. Mm-hmm. And did he work with the unions on this too? Because he got like people like Frank Sinatra to sign off and do this for free, right? I mean, and wasn't that part of the deal? He had to work with ASCAP and some of these.
Yeah, and the American Federation of Musicians. Right. There was a tussle there, but I think in the long run, it was better for all those organizations mm-hmm. to cooperate with mm-hmm. the war effort mm-hmm. than it was to, you know, have a union movement against it.
Right.
So he was successful in making that all happen, and that's part of Bob's brilliance. He mm-hmm. could make all these pieces fit. Mm-hmm. And so that was a huge project that eventually got him the Legion of Merit.
Right. V-Disc Vincent. I mean, was that something he called? Did he start that? I know people called him V-Disc Vincent at some point.
I don't know. He probably started.
Sounded like something he started.
Yeah, oh, sure. But, you know, we're making, you know, this is a 2-minute conversation about something that could be this whole program.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm sure you have all those recordings at the Voice Library.
We have MSU. Some. We have some, not all of them.
No.
We have a donor giving us a few in the near future, but no, we don't.
Well, I've heard a lot of them, and they're mm-hmm. all fun. They're great. Yeah. And you know, you get the artists like Glenn Miller, you know, talking to the boys overseas
right.
and introducing what they're going to hear.
Right.
And Tommy Dorsey mm-hmm. and Sinatra, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. You know, all the big stars.
Yes.
And Bob worked with them and knew them all. And
mm-hmm.
The next thing that I had on my list of things to discuss about Bob was the Nuremberg War Trials.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And as after the war, of course, Bob was the perfect guy for this because he understood the recording side of things.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to record all the proceedings at Nuremberg.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke fluent German. They sent him to Nuremberg,
mm-hmm.
and that's where he set up the multilingual sound system.
He was a captain. Is he a captain?
Point, he was a captain.
Yep.
Yeah. In fact, I used to call him Captain Bob.
Did you?
Oh, and he hated it. He always said, "Oh, you know, I'm a colonel. I'm not a captain. I'm a colonel." In fact, if you see the footage on television occasionally of mm-hmm. the Nuremberg War Trial, you'll see this small fellow running up to the, you know, Hermann Göring.
Really?
And fixing the, you know, getting the microphone
I've
ready.
I've seen that.
Yes,
that's
I've
amazing.
Seen him several times on television.
Wow.
And the other thing, that a little sidebar to that, is he always carried a picture in his wallet of him telling a joke in German to Hermann Göring. And I don't know if you ever saw that.
No.
He would flip people out when he'd show them that. He was leaning over the defendant's box, I guess you'd call it.
Yes.
And he's telling him a joke in German, and Göring's got this huge smile. He's laughing. And there's Bob, you know, right in the middle of it.
Mm. Well, he invented that system, right? When you see those pictures and they're wearing earphones, and they're speaking in English, like the lawyers, they're getting the translations instantly, right? And
yes.
That's his system.
Yes.
He engineered that. And later at the UN, he did the same thing.
Same thing.
Yep.
Which was his next big assignment, which was doing the same thing at the United Nations.
Right.
First in San Francisco.
Yes.
And then they moved east and set up in New York. And he was, I don't remember his title, but he was chief of sound and recording, I think, for the United Nations for
mm-hmm.
quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Into the 50s, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this career just took on a life of its own.
Yeah.
And all the time, he's still focused on what we're talking about, which is archival collections.
Right.
And building his own collection.
Right.
So then, you know, after he left the UN, then he went to California.
Okay.
And I believe this was in the early 50s, and this is when things started to transition for Bob, and he started to fall a little out of date because things were had moved from radio into television and film.
He's about 50 years old then,
yeah.
roughly 50, 52 or so. Yeah.
And so he felt the need to get out of New York and get out west, and that's where his son was. That's where Kenneth was.
Right.
And I know Viola, many times, his wife, mm-hmm. of course, instrumental in all of this, mm. you know, keeping the home fires burning.
Yes.
And we'll talk about her if we have time.
Yeah.
But she had this beautiful home in Mamaroneck, New York, that many times she pined about that. She said, "Oh, I wish we still had the house of Mamaroneck. Those were the best years. Those were the times she always remembered." And she would talk about all the people that would come over to the house and, you know, cooking and having feeds there. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, she's the perfect consummate host and cook and right. and all of that stuff. But that all kind of evaporated when they went to California. Mm. And at that point, he got into a lot of different things. He got into some construction businesses and things with his son. But he did still work in the industry. And he actually got an Academy Award for the work he did, the audio work he did on a documentary.
I didn't know this. He got an Academy Award.
He got an Academy Award.
Wow. As a sound engineer.
You know, I'm not sure what his entire role
in
was.
In any category, that's an amazing thing.
Yeah. And I remember seeing the film, and it was, what they had done is they animated still photographs. One of the first times they had photographs animated. Uh-huh. And by animated, it's kind of the stuff that Ken Burns does today, where you see things moving.
Uh-huh.
Well, this was very simple, and it was just, they'd have these photographs on a track moving in or out of the distance away from the camera, in and out.
Right.
So it gave some motion to what would have otherwise been just a black and white photograph.
Right.
And really made it much more visually stimulating.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he worked on out in California, along with a lot of other things he tried to get involved in, but never really amounted to a whole
right.
lot.
Always collecting those years, yes. Yep.
And then... shortly after that, I guess, in the early 60s, mm-hmm. brings it up to Michigan State University.
Yeah. And what happened there was, what I know of the story, he was living in California, as you say, and then director of libraries, his name was Richard E. Chapin, Dr. Chapin. He became head of the MSU libraries in the early 50s anyway. And then about 60, 61, he heard about Bob through an MSU professor named Herb Bergman, who taught ATL and had read about Bob Vinson in his collection. Because there's always been lots of press about Bob in the collection. I mean, he was in Time Magazine, as you know, the New York Times. And so while he was doing all these other things, he had the collection. And he knew Eleanor Roosevelt and played recordings for her at the White House, I believe. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah. And so Herb Bergman heard about Bob, and he went and talked to Chapin. He's a professor. He talked to Chapin. And back in the 60s, there was money, you know, so that the universities had money. And Dr. Chapin got in contact with Bob about bringing his collection to Michigan State University. So Bob must have been about our age now, like 60, 61, 62, you mm-hmm. know, not could have retired maybe, you know, if he'd had the money. But anyway, so Dr. Chapin actually went to California to court Bob and say, you know, we really want your collection here at Michigan State University. And Bob had talked to Yale about giving it to Yale at
yes,
some point.
That's right.
And I think that deal was cut, then fell through. And then I think maybe one of the California schools, too, maybe USC, he'd been talking to. So he was looking for a home for it. I don't know if he was looking for a job necessarily, but that certainly was an enticement. And I think from what you're saying, he was kind of maybe not exactly knowing what to do, doing lots of different things in California, but maybe not doing exactly what he wanted to do.
That's the impression I always had.
Yeah. So what he got really was offer of a job. Give your collection to MSU and come with it and become curator of the National Voice Library. So he comes to East Lansing, Michigan in 1962. And he had an interesting title. He was called head of the National Voice Library, but also assistant director to the director of libraries, or assistant to the director of libraries. So he had a direct contact with the director of libraries, and that's unusual because usually there's several layers in a big organization. So it's a major university library. So then the National Voice Library became then a unit of the Michigan State University Libraries. In a day when libraries weren't technical, you know, I mean, some libraries had media centers, but they usually had records you know, and, mm-hmm. and not even tapes in those days, right? Or no center at all. So what you've got is you establish the National Voice Library on the fourth floor of the West Wing of the MSU Libraries, and Bob is the head of it. And he created a recording studio there, and so he recorded people in his own studio in the MSU Libraries. He worked with collectors. He did travel a little bit, not as much as he wanted to do recordings. And as you know, and I think where you come back in again with this, is his collection was still in many different types of formats. Okay, so he had discs, he had 16-inch transcription discs, he had 78s, and he had Edison cylinders. So what he did was really bring all this stuff together in 7-inch reels of tape. We have about 10 minutes to go. So still analog, but, and you must have worked on that too, didn't you? I mean, were you doing dubbing for him while you were there? I know that that's a lot of what he did in the first few years. He created something like 2,000 reels of tape. Even at their 2,000 to 3,000 reels.
Yeah.
Plus, they started to catalog it too. So he identified the piece as a separate entity. So if it was a speech of Dwight Eisenhower on a given date and time, then that is that's a cataloged entry, as a book would be cataloged, mm-hmm. which has really been the strongest point of the Voice Library always, that a lot of things we don't have are unique, but the cataloging is unique, and the fact that it exists and all these things are findable. And then when you have all these reels, you have a very monolithic, in a way, you have rows and rows of reels that you can find these things, mm-hmm. you know.
I didn't do a whole lot of dubbing or transfers of anything. Mm-hmm. Mostly what I did was work on current productions and editing.
Yep.
And
he always did productions with the tapes.
So, I would come in a couple, three times a week, mm-hmm. and he'd have some programs that he had produced, or he'd have something that he wanted butted up or something.
Yeah.
And that's how I met him, actually. Mm-hmm. I was working at a recording studio where mm-hmm. I was a studio musician and working the board.
Right.
And got introduced to him one day at the library, and he said, yeah, let's give it a go. Mm-hmm. And he really didn't know what to think of me, you know, but as it turned out, we got along really well, mm-hmm. and it was a long-term relationship.
You were how old when you first met him?
I think it was 19.
19, yeah.
18 or 19.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in 69. If it was 69, I was 18,
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
But, I really got to know Bob and Vi quite well, and mm-hmm. I've got a few notes here I want to just talk about them as, you know, their personalities mm-hmm. and what they were like. Bob kept a daily journal, mm-hmm. and I know he worked on his memoirs, but never really got them done, and that was picked up by someone else. But, you know, I would see Bob working on his journal when I'd visit him at the house, when I'd show up at work. And one of the things about Bob is he always used a Mont Blanc pen. You know, and I never saw him write with anything other than that Mont Blanc pen. And, what he would call a Weltanschauung. I mean, he would always talk about the Weltanschauung, which is the German word for worldview. And he had a very unique Weltanschauung about him. And, he was definitely not an organization man. And, he was running solo his whole life. And he really didn't like bureaucracy. And so I know working at the library, you know, I could see that some of the things that would irritate him would be the bureaucratic stuff that he had to go through back then.
Yeah.
Because he'd never had to do it before. He was always the big cheese.
Right.
But he was always fun. And he was always doing something silly or fun. And a couple of the things that he would say almost on a daily basis is, it's all in fun, or it's a lark. You know, what a lark, he'd say, you know. And he always had that attitude about him. And I think of one situation that we were in. We went to a retired faculty club luncheon, and he was doing a presentation. And this was during the Watergate trials, and everybody was, you know, locked into these Watergate trials mm-hmm. on TV. And Bob always had me sit at the head table. Wherever we went with these presentations, I would always sit right next to him mm-hmm. because I was what he called his mascot. He would introduce me as Ronnie, his mascot. You know, and I would, you know, it was all in good humor and everything. Well, at this particular presentation, he had quite a walk up to the dais. And as he got up from the head table, he made a comment to the crowd. And there were probably 100 people, 150 people there. He said, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Ronnie, you know, to tell you a little bit more about, you know, what you're going to hear or something like that. And, I mean, I had no clue. Here I'm an 18-year-old kid, you know, in this room, and I'm probably wearing blue jeans and an old T-shirt, and I'm at the head table. So I stand up, and I threw out some throwaway line from the Watergate trials that everybody had been hearing, like, I have nothing to say about this at that time, at this time. Uh-huh. And everybody laughed. And, of course, Bob was chuckling when he got up to the microphone because he had just totally put me on the spot.
Right.
And he would do stuff like that all the time. And you know, Bob was a diminutive character. I mean, yes. I don't think he was 5 feet tall.
Yes.
And Vi was a carbon copy.
Yes, I saw them as a couple that just before he died. And they were just about the same height. I saw them at a grocery store, and they were
a perfect match. So anyway, you know, I could talk about all kinds of things that Bob had to say. One of his favorite lines, another one is, they all think it's on the level. We'd be sitting somewhere in a, whatever the situation is, and he thought it was just silly. Whatever was going on was silly. And he'd elbow me and he'd say, you know, they all think it's on the level. And he'd say that over and over again. And he always said that people either love him or hate him. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting, but I think true, because Bob was a very good judge of people, and he would read you very quickly. And if he didn't think you were on the level, mm-hmm. you know, he would let you know it. Mm-hmm. And so he said, you know, they either love me or hate me, mm-hmm. and I guess he believed that. Mm-hmm. One other thing I'd like to mention is I went to New York with him. First time I ever went to New York was, I believe, in 1971. And he wanted to go out there, and he was looking for some material or something. I don't remember exactly what the trip was for, but he also wanted to see his sister Ellen, who had been sick, I believe. Mm-hmm. So we hopped in his 61 Mustang GT, which was the oddest car for him to drive. It was a fast car, you know, but we hopped in the Mustang, went out to New York. He had me driving all through Manhattan. I'd never been out of the big city of East Lansing, I think, before then. But while we were out there, we called on Tony Janik, who I know has been a big contributor to the library now.
Yep.
And Tony worked for Columbia, mm-hmm. and he recorded off-air recordings, which you now have in your collection.
Right.
So I got to meet him at his home and his wife and see where his studio was. And we went to Syracuse University and met with a gentleman by the name of Walter Welch, who was also a collector and archivist. And he had a studio there and a collection there, mm-hmm. at Syracuse University. And we went everywhere. We walked into CBS like he owned the place. Yes. And we were walking through all the studios, and it was like nobody asking for an ID or anything. It's just, there he is. And the Yale Club, we went to the Yale Club. When we first got there, we went to the Times Square Motor Hotel, which I think he thought was still in a pretty good state of affairs, but it was just a terrible, run-down hotel at that point. So the next day, he moved us over to the Hilton and did the right thing. But my first exposure to New York with a guy who was a native New Yorker, and it was like he owned the place.
Yeah.
He'd go anywhere he wanted to, and fascinating. Let's see. As far as the library, you know, the one thing that I remember editing on all the time was the Magna Quarter, which he called the Maggie.
Yeah, the Maggies. There are three of them in a row, and we still have those machines, too.
Yeah, yep,
they're excellent. They're the highest quality possible at that time.
Yeah, and they're great to edit on because they had the exposed tape heads.
Yep, they were same as owned by Sam Phillips at Sun Studios that Elvis recorded with.
Interestingly, I was in Sun Studios three weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, and first time I was there. But Bob was not an academic. I'm kind of bouncing around here, but he wasn't an academic.
Yep.
He didn't really fit in that world. But boy, he had a lot of great information and great history to pass on.
Yeah.
he had a Steinway that was given to him by Mr. Steinway. I recall that.
Huh.
And, you know, he got that when he was in Nuremberg and had a lot of things in their home that were just,
Know, lived in East Lansing, and he died in 85. They were living still in East Lansing.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't know how we're doing on time here, but, okay. Any questions you have?
No, this is fascinating for me, having worked, been associated with the Voice Library for so long and hearing bits and pieces about Bob Minson, who was even, I think, more famous and more interesting than I ever thought.
You know, I have a lot of stuff that I promised you I would share with you, and it's probably been 10 years since I first started writing those little vignettes down that you've got a couple of, but I do intend to do that.
Right. And I think you should read the quote from that. Bob wrote an incredible piece about the Voice Library for the Library Journal in 65. And it really, I think it sums up I think when he came to East Lansing with the collection, what he did was at that age he pondered a lot of what it meant and what voice recording meant to him. And I think that this talks about that. And the whole idea of the Voice Library is that recorded sound brings another dimension to understanding history. So you can read all of the speeches of Franklin Roosevelt, but it's not the same as listening to them. Mm-hmm. And that's what Bob Vincent was all about. And he really brings an intellectual perspective or a worldview to that in this quote. And I've had this quote in lots of presentations I've done, and I think you reading it is really significant.
All right. This was in the Library Journal, October 15, 1965. We can understand a man's ideas through our intellect, but to know him really, to know him as a full, vivid, rounded personality, we must respond to him not only intellectually, but also emotionally. This response can often be immediately evoked when we hear his voice, the timbre of the voice, the inflections, the accents, the very hesitations and imperfections of his utterance tell a story which cannot be conveyed by mere alphabetic symbols. Print stands for the word, but it never is, it never can be, the word itself. Only the spoken voice can bring the word fully to life. G. Robert Vincent.
That's great.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, Ron.